Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com.
Hello, this is Mikey McGovern, and you're listening to New Books in Medicine. Harlem, 1946. One of the most celebrated young black writers of a generation, a maligned German-American psychiatrist, and a prominent pastor descend into the basement of St. Philip's Episcopal Church. I recently spoke with Gabriel Mendez, assistant professor of ethnic studies and urban studies at the University of California, San Diego, about his new book, Under the Strain of Color, Harlem's Lafargue Clinic and the Promise of an Anti-Racist Psychiatry, published in 2015 by Cornell University Press. Mendez follows this unlikely set of actors through their respective careers and the establishment of the Lafargue Clinic, perhaps the first institution of its kind, aimed at accounting for the psychiatric ramifications of racial oppression and redressing the lack of access to mental health care faced by Harlem's black community. The clinic advocated for a then-radical social psychiatry that took racial and economic oppression seriously, a vision born of the aforementioned author Richard Wright's interaction with the Communist Party and Chicago School Sociology, mixed with psychiatrist Frederick Wortham's idiosyncratic approach to psychoanalysis. Establishing accessible, affordable therapy and psychiatric court testimony for the population of Harlem was a grassroots effort that provided hitherto inaccessible services. Yet it was overlooked by state measures for community mental health in the 1950s and eventually wound down, in itself a parable for contemporary efforts to address racialized health disparities, especially regarding mental health. I enjoyed talking with Gabriel about his own intellectual trajectory and the very rich literatures and material drawn on by the book. This is one for scholars of the politics of health, African-American and urban studies, 20th century literature, for its focus on Wright as much as its reevaluation of Wortham, who's typically painted as a reactionary, and especially those interested in the troubled legacy of American psychiatry.
Hi, everyone. This is Mikey McGovern, and you're listening to New Books in Medicine. I'm here today speaking with Gabriel Mendez, assistant professor of ethnic studies at UC San Diego, about his new book, Under the Strain of Color, Harlem's Lafargue Clinic and the Promise of an Anti-Racist Psychiatry. Gabriel, welcome to New Books in Medicine.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be in conversation with you. Thank you.
So the way we like to start things on the New Books Network is by having each of our authors give us a sense of their own intellectual trajectory,
sure,
how they came into the field and how they came to write the work at hand. So I would love if you could chart your terrain for us, as it were.
Yeah. I went to graduate school at Brown University in the Department of American Civilization. They still had the name American Civilization at the time that I attended. They've since subsequently changed it to American Studies, but in a lot of ways, as many people know, the title American Civilization was a kind of it was birthed and elaborated in the Cold War era to enunciate the exceptional qualities of American society and history and culture. But yeah, I attended the American Civilization Department. Prior to that, I attended my undergraduate degree was at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York, and I majored in Africana studies and religious studies. So it was a double major. And then subsequently, a year and a half, approximately 2 years after graduating from Hobart, I went to Harvard Divinity School. So I did a religious studies, Master of Theological Studies, which is more of a study of, as opposed to the ministerial practice of religion. And it was an extraordinary experience because I arrived at Harvard Divinity School the very same year that Professor Cornel West joined the faculty in African American studies and over in the Divinity School. So that was an extraordinary experience. But when I pursued the doctoral program in American studies at Brown, I always envisioned myself having also one foot in Africana studies or African American studies or we could even Afro diasporic studies broadly mm-hmm. construed. And what was great about the time that I arrived at Brown in 2001, I was there officially 2001 to 2009. But what was great about that was the Africana Studies Department did not yet have a graduate program. So the professors there were very excited to welcome graduate students from other programs, other graduate programs throughout the university, and really it allowed me to glom onto them, so to speak. And I ended up being a teaching assistant in both American Studies and in Africana Studies. And what was really exciting about the time that I arrived there and actually feeds into how this book, Under the Strain of Color, took shape initially as my dissertation, which I'll mention in just a minute. Mm-hmm. What was exciting was there were a batch of scholars there who were really reckoning with the work of the Martinican psychiatrist and anti-colonial thinker Frantz Fanon, and well, anti-colonial fighter as well. I mean, he abjured or abdicated his position as a French colonial psychiatrist and joined the Algerian Revolution. So, yes, he was both. Many know he was both a theorist, thinker, and an activist. So, but what the questions they were, the scholars there were reckoning with, often bore down to the question of the lived experience of racialization, and particularly what it meant to live Black in an anti-Black society. And so, one of the main texts that I read and reread with figures like Lewis R. Gordon, the philosopher Lewis Gordon, and the sociologist Paget Henry at Brown was we read Black Skin, White Mass very closely, both in terms of its connections and origins in a set of questions in psychoanalysis, but also in phenomenology and other philosophical concerns. So both the kind of nuts and bolts psychoanalytic questions, as well as the question of method of the phenomenology of in the book, it's translated as into English as the fact of blackness, but it's at more aptly the lived experience of the black. And so a set of questions emerged for me that took shape in relation to what I was learning in American studies as well. And that main question was the relationship between normality and pathology as constructed and enacted in the human sciences, and as it intersect with the changing meanings of race. Mm-hmm. And so while I entered that line of inquiry through the more theoretically sophisticated dimensions of working through Fanon, I always pick up those theoretical questions and see how they may translate or be identified in a set of historical circumstances or questions. And so at the very same moment that I was engaging sort of a Fanonian, Fanon studies, so to speak, I was also engaging a real, what I like to call a kind of a boomlet in American historiography on the human sciences at the level of intellectual history, but also policy history and theoretical questions, but just a broad ranging emergent set of texts. I'm thinking of Alice O'Connor's Poverty Knowledge, Ellen Herman's Romance of American Psychology, and probably for me the most important of that body of texts was Daryl Michael Scott's Contempt and Pity. It's the image of the damaged black psyche in American policy. That's the subtitle or some iteration of that. And so I had on one side a real thoroughgoing theoretical body of work I was reeling from, so to speak, but also very excited to engage in tracing the genealogies of the human sciences and how they intersected with questions of race and racialization. Mm-hmm. And so to put a kind of a punctuation on this is that when I proposed my dissertation, it was a really ambitious, wide ranging study I called Living the Dilemma, African American Encounters with the Human Sciences in Postwar America, which is wow. Just a very capacious topic. And I always say to my to graduate students, and I have no idea how my dissertation committee accepted that, because it was really a multi-volume work in the offing. And so the way, if would you allow me to just talk a little bit about that dissertation topic?
And yeah.
Each chapter was supposed to be a four or five chapter dissertation, very much mapped along a life cycle, and in many ways I took a cue from the autobiography of Malcolm X to look at the sites in which a young African American, in this case man, encounters in both discourses and institutions the knowledge that's produced about him. And so I imagined a project that looked like this: social work, a chapter on social work, right? The family, the initial site of which the human sciences are brought to bear on everyday people. So social work, and then education and schools, public schools, and then juvenile delinquency, and then a psychiatric clinic. Because there's this famous moment in autobiography of Malcolm X where where Malcolm X Young, well, he's still Malcolm Little, feigns madness. He fakes madness in order to get out of service in the military. And he's where he famously says, well, he's frantic to join the Japanese army. And they're like, whoa, 4F. So anyway, the last was to be prisons. And so what happened was I initially did a little foray into some of those other possible chapters, but then by sheer accident of timing, I was slated to teach a course called African American Autobiography as an advanced graduate student at Brown. And I was slated to teach it in spring and got notified just about a month before the start of the fall semester that, hey, we need this course now. And so I began to do my homework. And this is the very same time where I formulated the dissertation topic. I was doing my syllabus construction and knowing that I was working on going to work with Richard Wright, who, as you know, is a co-founder of the Lafarge Clinic. That's the subject of Under the Strain of Color. I'm doing all this background on Wright, and in a chronology of Wright's life and work, it says 1946 co-founds the Lafarge Mental Hygiene Clinic in Harlem with Jewish German psychiatrist Dr. Frederick Wertham, and like Deus ex machina, like light bulbs and all lightning, and as you might have thunder soon, come out of nowhere. And I say, and I still have that chronology, and it says, I wrote next to it, look up, like look that up, like look that up. And so I did, I looked that up, and it turned out that, while, you know, this was going to be just one chapter in that larger ambitious dissertation project, it really I went down, as I would say to my dissertation advisor Jim Campbell, I went down the research rabbit hole. I went down the archival rabbit hole and actually yielded I yielded enough material that I made the case that this should be the focus of the whole dissertation project and manuscript. And so
sort of like an inversion of what you thought your approach was going to be.
Absolutely.
You're tracing a life through different institutions. It ends up being that in one institution, many, many different lives kind of coalesce.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's a really apt description. And so I was able to locate archival materials at the Schomburg Center. It's an interesting story because I was able to locate archival material from the clinic itself, but very, all things considered, quite limited. There were approximately four archival boxes of material that the physician in charge, Hilda L. Massey of the Lafarge Clinic, left and dedicated to the Schomburg Center. But that's not very many. And in fact, there are approximately only 40 patient files. But there were clinic records, there was correspondence. And I was able to kind of go the back route. There were the archives of Richard Wright at the Beinecke Library. And also I began to think, who would Wertham have corresponded with and who were his mentors? So and for those of those in the history of medicine and psychiatry, I located in the papers of the Dean of American Psychiatry, Adolf Meyer, of Johns Hopkins. And turned out that there was a trove of letters and correspondence and reports on Wertham, who, I mean, you know, we'll get to shortly, I'm sure, you know, in depth. But the real, when I said it's an interesting story, the Frederick Wertham collection at the Library of Congress was restricted and closed to me during the entire dissertation research and writing process. It wasn't until 2010 that I was able to gain access. They opened up And I'm sure there's within the next 5 years, there's going to be a bunch of new texts that draw in some ways on the Wortham papers.
Mm.
So yeah. And in a lot of ways, you know, one of the things that that is a kind of, a methodological and historiographic, quandary and question that I discuss with students and colleagues is, you know, how much material is enough to construct a narrative, right? To reconstruct a narrative or construct whatever word you want to use. And that was always, you know, I had what my advisor, Jim Campbell, referred to as dissertation disease initially, where I felt like I needed to have a strictly source-driven, he loved it. He loved that I was rigorous about citation and I needed every document to correspond to a claim I made. And I think that's a really proper intention and orientation. But the story doesn't strictly depend on just having, you know, one like a piece of datum to correspond. That I was able to glean from both primary and secondary sources enough to really make some claims about the significance of the Lafargue Clinic and of the trajectory of its co-founders and ultimately its impact and legacy on both questions of race in the human sciences and in the medical sciences, and also its significance to the field of mental health care proper. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Excellent. That was a great overview into your approach to the project. And so I'm just wondering if you could summarize briefly for us just before we dive into deeper discussion in the context of the book. So what was the Lafargue Clinic? How long did it run? What was sort of, what's the kind of time scale and the scope we're looking at right here?
Yeah. So the Lafargue Mental Hygiene Clinic was the first outpatient psychiatric clinic in and for the community of Harlem, New York. It opened in March of 1946 and closed at the end of 1958. And it operated every Tuesday and Friday evenings out of the basement of the St. Philip's Episcopal Church in Harlem on 134th Street. And it was staffed by an all-volunteer all-volunteer staff made up of a number of the co-founder Dr. Wortham's students and colleagues, as well as some community members in Harlem. For most cases, each therapy session, it didn't require a referral. It could be walk-in. Each session was cost a quarter. Dr. Wortham actually got the nickname in the neighborhood of Dr. Quarter. He was called Dr. Quarter amongst folks in Harlem, and it was free if you couldn't pay that quarter. And so each session was 30 minutes, an hour in some cases, and it cost 50 cents for one of the doctors to testify in court for any reason. And the clinic is very much emblematic of an attention to the need for extending greater mental health services, and yet in that larger effort to extend mental health services, very little attention was given to the needs of African Americans and other marginalized communities, and to the poor in general. Mm-hmm. And in the very same year that the Lafargue Clinic was established, Congress dedicated funds to the establishment of the National Institute of Mental Health. I believe it didn't really get up and running till 1949. I'm pretty decent with dates, but I know that the effort was initiated for the National Institute of Mental Health in 1946. And so, you know, like if you look at that in terms of a parallel kind of you know, not to be too corny about it, but zeitgeist. There is an unprecedented attention to the necessity for mental health services for the American citizenry. And, but yet that didn't trickle down. Neither the actual institutional level didn't trickle down to African Americans, and the orientation of the LaFar Clinic was distinctive in terms of its mm-hmm. attention to its explicit attention to the experiences of anti-Black racism and labor or class exploitation and subjugation. So both. In terms of both its diagnostic and therapeutic orientations. So there's this, you know, there's the kind of nuts and bolts of the clinic. And the context is, you know, there's unprecedented attention, but where are the needs of African Americans entering into this? And the title of the book, Under the Strain of Color, comes from, a 1947 Negro Digest article called Brown Breakdown, in which the author Kay Crimmins actually poses that very question of, well, okay, this is going, and she uses the military as a kind of a site to expand and elaborate to American society. Well, okay, so you know that in the midst of World War II, many soldiers cracked under the pressure. Well, what about African Americans who experience daily onslaughts and are cracking under the strain of color? And I've always found that such a resonant image and reference. And so that then became, in coordination with the editors of Cornell University Press, that became the title of the book.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. That's fascinating. And actually, to, you know, while on the subject of some of your material and the ways in which it, you know, inspires and in a way, like, kind of theorizes itself when selected mm-hmm. properly, I wanted to quote from one of your chapters where there's a page that's mm-hmm. sort of a memo that Wortham pens called The Objectives yeah. of the LaFar Clinic. And I think it really does kind of address all the things you just spoke to.
Yeah.
Just a quote from that. It says, "Public should be acquainted with the fact that discrimination exists in psychiatry. Example, psychiatric institute does not take Negroes as patients. Individual cases cannot be understood if the above points are not recognized." Continues to mention political consciousness, defined by Dr. Wortham as knowing what's going on. And then he says, "Many who have the opportunity to know what's going on do not accept it. No big theories are needed. No prejudices." In a way, I think that kind of is very emblematic of the mission of what seems to be kind of a counter institution, right? It's functioning
yeah.
In the basement of a church, and
yes.
you know, figures who would otherwise, who we'll get into in a sec, you know, mm-hmm. be really, really major, not marginal, but sort of major movers and shakers in their respective backgrounds and fields, kind of coming together to form, yeah, this kind of counter institution in a way.
Yes, yes. I'm glad you zeroed in on that passage, that memo. I mean, I rarely in the book have these kind of big block quotes, just to let your readers
right.
know. Like, I try to really distill the source material into a readerly narrative. And so, yet that fragmented list of approaches to me was so resonant and evocative because it distilled the approach, the orientation in such a clear way in terms of both the kind of the explicit connection between the science and the politics of psychiatry at mid-century, right? In the mm-hmm. sense that it, in order to do good psychotherapy in the community of Harlem, it had to address the, and when I say politics, I really think in terms of power, right? And whenever I hear politics, I hear power. That's the word that goes right next. And in terms of the kind of the distribution of power in the society. Remember, this is the clinic is founded in the midst, or on the kind of tail, in the midst of the second wave of the Great Migration of African Americans out of the 11 states of the former Confederacy to urban industrial centers, you know, thinking, of course, of the arsenal of democracy, Detroit, you know, of course, Philadelphia, even out west where I am in San Diego and very much Los Angeles. But of course, New York. And so in the midst of this great migration, African-Americans are, while, you know, still imagining a promised land of the North, they're encountering a ghetto. You know, I one of the beginning portions of chapter three of the book, which I'm we'll get to, I just want to kind of set the stage a little, is that, you know, Harlem remains both a mecca of the Black, you know, as from the Harlem Renaissance days of the Black, the capital of Black America, but it's also, in the words of Claude Brown, author of Man Child and the Promised Land, it's a closet sized ghetto, right? Mm-hmm. And so to disregard the social context of the, you know, the lived experience of the patients before them who come and sit down with them, to disregard, right, those components of the racial context, the political of a higher type of psychiatry, that it would be a dereliction of the work of psychiatry, mm-hmm, according mm-hmm. to Wortham, right? So there's this quote I'd like to share with you that in line with that, and it comes from the introduction where I want to kind of introduce actually a little bit of the orientation, and it connects to what you just posted. May I share that portion?
Absolutely.
It's, yeah. This comes in, on page 16 of the introduction. It's a paragraph I'd like to, if you bear with me. Wright and Wortham embraced psychological discourse and the science of psychiatry as tools for understanding Black experiences of modern American society. Yet they resisted the general aim of the behavioral sciences to help the putatively abnormal to adjust to the norms of society. Instead, they sought to develop psychiatric knowledge and therapy that might aid everyday people in confronting the social order of white supremacy and capitalist exploitation. To do so, Wortham developed a distinctive version of, quote, social psychiatry, an orientation to psychiatric diagnosis and psychotherapy that incorporated the social world of the patient into the overall picture of mental health. Mm-hmm. Wortham did not coin the term social psychiatry, but in his writings and public appearances, he consistently trumpeted his particular brand of conjoining the social sciences and psychiatry as a unique advance in understanding the sources. And here we get to like etiology, right? The origins and sources, the sources and in the treatment of personality problems and mental disorders. If you allow me, I just want to finish this paragraph because I think it's resonant. Social psychiatry was an attempt to reorient the field of mental health care toward a, quote, progressive social point of view, end of quote. And acknowledging the political nature of his efforts, Wortham explained that social psychiatry, quote, does not introduce social partisanship into psychiatry. Social psychiatry uncovers scientifically its unconscious or conscious presence in every form of psychiatry that has ever existed. There is no science dealing with human beings that is completely unpolitical, end of quote. And lastly, psychiatry as practiced at mid-century was sadly on the wrong side of history, according to Wortham, becoming more reactionary and authoritarian as the great cry for democracy went out from everyday people all over the world. Social psychiatry, Wortham declared, and this is the last sentence, social psychiatry, Wortham declared, quote, affirms that in the historical development of society and its use or abuse of science, periods may occur where seeming adaptation becomes maladaptation, adjustment, maladjustment, normality, a burden, vaunted health, an insidious disease. In short, where the physician may be sicker than his patient. Hmm. And so that even that's from a lecture that he gave in front. That's really interesting. He gave that lecture at Columbia University at the Psychiatric Institute, which wasn't allowing African Americans treatment at the time.
Right.
And so, yeah.
And I think that's a very proper way to introduce Wortham himself. I think that, it would be good to maybe turn to his background.
Sure.
Just because, I mean, so you kind of, you addressed this a bit in your introduction, but so he had experience working with Adolf Meyer at Johns Hopkins, and he was sort of always kind of on the margins of American psychiatry.
Yeah.
A lot of it was chalked up to personal issues and sort of difficulties he had, and trust issues with other physicians, or sorry, psychiatrists, going back to Germany. And so he had this fascinating trajectory, but he sort of pretty resolutely throughout is very much committed to the social mission that he sees as core to psychiatry that, you know, his contemporaries have strayed from. So how would you characterize Wortham? And more importantly, even, how would you characterize how his particular brand of social psychiatry that he develops over time clashes with the mainstream of American psychiatry?
That's a great way of both telling his background and more specifically what indeed makes him this I say in the book simultaneously prominent and marginal, which is hard to do and hard to be, both prominent and marginal at the same time. So Wortham was born in Nuremberg, Bavaria, to a non-religious middle-class Jewish family, born in 1895, and comes of age in Kaiser Wilhelm, like pre World War I Germany. But he's got cousins. I'm going to try to condense this best. But it's really significant where he is educated and who he works with. Mm-hmm. Because it sets the stage for how he encounters American psychiatry, its orientations, and where he diverges from them. And so he has cousins, and I love history. This is where I love his one of his cousins is Ella Winter. Ella Winter was a communist, a radical journalist, who eventually marries later on in her life Lincoln Steffens, the muckraking journalist. For those in progressive history land, you'll resonate with Lincoln Steffens. And those of you in radical and Marxist history will be fascinated by the connection to Ella Winter. Anyway, Wortham was bilingual from a very early age, both German and English, and so he would spend summers in Britain with the Winters, and on his paternal relatives, and he ends up choosing King's College to attend for his baccalaureate degree. But guess what? He enrolls like just at the guns of August 1914, of the onset of World War I. And as an enemy alien, he is put in an internment camp during the war. But during the war, he was I don't know if they had it then, but it was basically pre-med at King's College. And to get to the real nuts and bolts, he works with some other interned medical doctors, and one happens to be a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, and he becomes, I don't recall the man's name right now, I'm sorry, but that he becomes fascinated with what Wortham himself refers to as medical psychology, and you know, broadly construed, and I think it's in the internment camp period that he begins to see himself entering the field of psychiatry. And so he gets an MD. At the end of the war. And for reasons I don't know, because there's nothing in the archival or secondary source material. I don't know why, but he does decide to go back to Germany at the end of the war. Post-World War I Germany, he gets his MD at the University of Würzburg and begins postgraduate training to become a psychiatrist, at some very prestigious institutions, and one of them happens to be with the Kraepelin Institute, the Emil Kraepelin Institute, and Emil Kraepelin is still alive, active and running and directing the German Institute for German Psychiatry. I'm not getting the exact phrasing correct, probably, but Emil Kraepelin is the singular most important German psychiatrist, if not one of the singular important psychiatrist alongside Sigmund Freud and some maybe a couple of other of his of names I'm not referencing, but Emil Kraepelin is the father of modern nosology, which is classification of mental disorders. He is the first to study, document, and in some ways treat the two major psychoses of, at the time they're called dementia praecox, which becomes in 1911 kind of elaborated on by Eugen Bleuler of schizophrenia. So that's dementia praecox, and then manic depressive disorder, which becomes later, you know, the diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And but one of the things about I'm probably speaking too long on this. I'll get going a little further in a second. But this is really important, is that Kraepelin is a reactionary German nationalist who is who for Wortham and for me in subsequent for those of us on who he becomes a he aligns psychiatry with rear guard politics in a really ugly way, an unseemly marriage of conservative reactionary politics and psychiatry, and it becomes, in my interpretation, a cautionary tale for Wortham, and in the midst of his time with the Kraepelin Institute, begins to kind of put out feelers for positions in the United States. And so he actually is connected by a couple of doctors sojourning briefly in Germany. He gets connected with Adolf Meyer and the Phipps Institute at Johns Hopkins, and Meyer takes him on. Meyer takes him on as a junior, I think it was called a junior alienist. That's what they, you know, they called psychiatrists. But he comes to be in Baltimore, and here's where it becomes particularly relevant for his later work. He comes to Baltimore, which is a peculiar city. It's a segregated city. It's a Jim Crow city, but it's not in the Confederacy, right? It's a segregated city, and yet he Wortham comes to align himself with the plight of African American patients in need of care, and in those kind of where I tend to see Wortham as a zealot figure encountering some of the kind of stars of history. He becomes acquainted with H.L. Mencken and Clarence Darrow. And Clarence Darrow, the great lawyer, brings African-American clients who need psychiatric testimony, brings these African-American patients to a young Dr. Wortham. Mm. And so from 1922 to 1927, Wortham is in the segregated Baltimore, and then is pushed out of that position because of, as the title of chapter two is, intangible difficulties. That's the description that Meyer uses in a quote unquote recommendation letter. Let's call it a reference letter. address your question is that he, is at the center of, developments, in American psychiatry at Phipps, and yet begins that process of becoming marginal, both on a personal and a kind of a racial political level of countering the grain of the kind of order of institutional politics, and he brings that with him to. As he, after a brief foray back to Germany in the early 1930s, he becomes the first psychiatrist on the Court of General Sessions in New York City, and that's where he enters into the field of forensic psychiatry and criminal psychopathology, which ultimately is the path that leads him to encountering Richard Wright in the early 1940s. Richard Wright, the novelist, wrote Native Son and then and a number of other important texts. One of the signal figures in African American literature and politics, to be quite frank and straightforward with that. And it's through Wortham's work in the Court of General Sessions, in forensic psychiatry, in criminal psychopathology, that he begins to formulate a version of a notion of social psychiatry, of taking into consideration the social determinants of mental health and mental disorder. And I just want to say one last thing on that, and I always imagine this narrative in terms of convergence. So how do we get Wortham and Wright in a room in 1945 planning to open the first psychiatric clinic in Harlem? And it's through this concern over both individual and collective violence rooted in both the social order, but also in forms of mental disorder that are also referred to as psychopathology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And another huge thing, right, is the influence of psychoanalysis on personality analysis and focusing
absolutely
on culture, but culture at the expense of one's actual social situation.
Absolutely.
Right? And that's
absolutely
something that I think that to turn to, you know, our next figure, as you so gracefully signaled, that's a similar trajectory to the one that Richard Wright has in kind of navigating through, his own intellectual upbringing, a lot of which took place kind of informally in Chicago. Interacting sometimes with figures of the Chicago School of Sociology.
Yes.
So how is it that Richard Wright came to Harlem to found this clinic as a kind of young thinker and novelist?
Yeah, I love it. I love the way you pose the question too. And I mean, just a quick word about the structure of the book that kind of helps tie this together a bit is the structure of the book is of Under the Strain of Color is an introduction, four standalone topical chapters, and an epilogue, and the first two chapters do exactly what I tried to talk about just now, which is How do we get these two really disparate figures, and who in their own ways are both prominent and marginal? And I'll explain a little bit more in Wright's case about that. But I've always thought about those initial chapters, the first chapter being on Richard Wright and the psychology of race relations as the subtitle. And then the second chapter being the chapter on Frederick Wortham, Intangible Difficulties. The third chapter is a kind of wholesale kind of anatomy of the Lafargue Clinic, really the kind of orientation, nuts and bolts, practices, has some patient file discussion and like the, it sets the context for the clinic. It's a real kind of, to coin a birth of the clinic, right? The birth, life, and death of the clinic in some ways, not as much death yet, but the birth and life of the clinic. The fourth chapter looks at, the role of the Lafargue Clinic and particularly Dr. Wortham in two prominent social phenomena and controversies of the day. One being the public school desegregation cases that culminated in Brown v. Board of Education school desegregation ruling of the Supreme Court. And the other, the juvenile delinquency debates of the 1950s, most saliently distilled in Frederick Wortham's infamous or famous, depending on your persuasion, 1954 book, Seduction of the Innocent, which I believe we will at least have a moment to chat about subsequently. But that's just to give you a quick overview, I think would kind of help because it, what I wanted to do in the first two chapters on Wright and Wortham was to, in many ways, map, and I use that word not just kind of figuratively, but to map the intellectual biography and geography. I think the geography of both figures is very important. And to connect just to directly to your question of Chicago is, Richard Wright is born in 1908 in Mississippi, grows up in the deepest Jim Crow South. Many of your listeners probably have read Black Boy, and hopefully the second portion that most many have not read is American Hunger. The whole autobiography was originally titled American Hunger. But get to the point is, he's born in 1908, grows up in Jackson, and then partially in Helena, Arkansas. I think it was Helena in Arkansas. Migrates to Chicago, to the south side of Chicago in 1927, joining that stream of migrants out of the old and quote unquote new south, right? And you know, encounters the city of Chicago and its urban anomie and both the beauties of anonymity and the terrors of anonymity, so to speak, in modern industrial life in Chicago. And you know, as he says in, and I quote, he said, "When I arrived in Chicago, I had a vague yearning to write, but I didn't have the tools I needed. I needed something to to orient and fasten his expression of his own and others' lives." And through a sheer, it couldn't be scripted better. He during the Great Depression, as it hits really hard in Chicago, the onset of in the late 29 and into the 30s, he and his family have to seek what was then called relief, which is welfare, right? And he gets a social worker. His social worker is Mary Wirth, and ears are probably perking up now because Mary Wirth is married to the great Chicago school sociologist, Dr. Lewis Wirth, who was one of the most prolific and important figures in Chicago school urban sociology. For those, I recommend everybody who wants a quick digest of read his American Journal of Sociology piece called Urbanism as a Way of Life. I still teach that in my urban studies classes. Yeah. I'm jointly appointed in ethnic studies and urban studies and planning. Mm. But through this sheer accident, as Wright is hungering for facts and social theory to explain both his experience and that of his fellow migrants into the city of Chicago, his fellow African-American migrants, he encounters a wholesale explanatory framework of what was called urban ecology, of thinking about the ways in which different ethno-racial groups interact on the landscape of the city. And but not only was there an attention to group encounter, there was an attention in the Chicago School to the psychology. A lot of that's often overlooked in discussions of, there was a lot of attention through early kind of life history and ethnography to what city life did to the psyche of the newly migrated and their children. And so encountering Mary Worth, encountering Lewis Worth, he found in the Chicago School the rudiments of a set of social theories about the effects of modernity on the modern psyche. And at the very same moment that he's encountering the Chicago School, he attends a meeting of the John Reed Club, which was the literary arm of the American Communist Party. And I believe it was 1932 or 1933, Richard Wright joins the American Communist Party. And he joins the South Side unit. They're broken into units, and he's part of the South Side unit, which is predominantly or almost all African American because of the South Side ghetto, right? And so at the same time he's encountering the Chicago School, he's encountering radical social theory and politics through Marx, and add the third variable that goes into shaping his intellectual orientation and armament, and that's the American fiction writers, the naturalists and realists, who actually oftentimes took Chicago as its site, namely Theodore Dreiser and other. Other novelists. And so he's incorporating and assessing and taking this all in. And at the same time, he's got his own experiences of life and work. And he begins to write. He begins to write short stories and poetry. And it's also by the mid 1930s that he does encounter psychoanalysis, but he's not fully steeped in that. And part of my case, my kind of argument in that chapter is that while he never fully in any way jettisons or throws away what he's learned in Chicago, it's in New York, it's in his geographical movements that he comes into contact with different ideas, institutions that then come to the fore. And for him, his departure from Chicago in 1937, that corresponds in the late 1930s to his full, deep, at least his initial major foray into understanding psychoanalysis, and in particular, and this is where the convergence with Wright Wortham happens, mm-hmm. is in the question of psychopathology, right? What are the sources of mental stress, mental disorder that may lead someone to act criminally, of violence, of acts of either self violence or violence against others. And it comes to be, that interest famously comes to be expressed in the monumental watershed book of Native Son, which he charts the life, a brief portion of the life of the famous Bigger Thomas character. Mm-hmm. And it's in this moment of 1940 is when that's published. And then at the very same time that Wright is writing of Bigger Thomas, Wortham is writing a book on a young Italian immigrant named Gino. Well, it's a pseudonym. A young Italian immigrant named Gino who commits matricide by stabbing his mother for her, alleged promiscuity. She's a widow. I won't get too far into that, but the point is that the book is called Dark Legend, A Study in Murder, and it and at the suggestion of Ella Winter, the linkage of the linkages is the figure of Ella Winter, who I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. as the cousin of Dr. Wortham. Ella Winter knows Wright through radical circles, through the Communist Party circles, and suggests to Wortham, hey, why don't you send your book Dark Legend mm-hmm. To Richard Wright, who has become the most famous African-American author in the country, if not the world, because of the Native Son is adopted by the Book of the Month Club mm-hmm. and gets into homes because, if you're on the Book of the Month Club, you receive the book, right? And it gets into homes that it never would have probably had it not been for the Book of the Month Club. And so it sets into motion a connection between these two who really, it would be easy to say that Wortham was the kind of guide and mentor. And that's not wholly accurate, right? Right. Because, I like the idea of Wortham as this, the scientific practitioner, for the hungry for knowledge, hungry for scientific knowledge and practice. Right. But in many ways they had an equal exchange. Wortham, and not in a kind of patronizing way, wanted more insight into letters into fiction, but also African American life, insight into the experience of being black in an anti-black society.
Right, and I think that you definitely get at this in the chapter on the clinic itself, but one of the major criticisms of the clinic that emerges from the kind of status quo of American psychiatry is that, what is a white German Jewish man in Harlem setting up a clinic for black patients? Like they sort of see it as this kind of incommensurability. There's no way that a black patient would have any reason to trust this guy. He really has no business there otherwise. So with that, I want to get to the actual, how the mechanics of the clinic worked a bit more.
Yes,
so
yes.
It was housed in St. Philip's Church, I believe.
St. Philip's Episcopal on West, West 134th Street. To address your question, there's a third figure who's very important to the history and to the narrative, and that's the figure of Father Shelton Hale Bishop. Father Shelton Hale Bishop is the rector, pastor of St. Philip's, and he, at a time when there wasn't a large degree of rapprochement or embrace between the ministry, or at least Christian ministry, let alone African American churches and the field of medical psychology, psychiatry. Bishop embraces the idea of the clinic, mm-hmm. and he embraces embraces Dr. Wortham's earnest investment, and I don't know exactly how it played out, but Wortham was vouched for by Richard Wright. I mean, no less than Richard Wright and another important figure, Ralph Ellison. Mm-hmm. Ralph Ellison, author of Invisible Man, plays a kind of a minor role in this history.
He's part of the clinic, correct?
Yeah. Well, he was ensconced in the Harlem community at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing in some archival reference had introduced, Wright and Wortham to Father Bishop. Mm-hmm. And later, just a quick note, later Ellison, would come to write what I think is one of the most extraordinary pieces, essays on the Lafar Clinic called Harlem is Nowhere, which is published in, well, actually it was acquired by, a magazine called Magazine of the Year, but it was actually that magazine folded and the essay was actually never published until 1964 in Ellison's Shadow and Act. And just as an important footnote for those of you in Chicago, the Art Institute of Chicago is just opened an exhibition on which captures the and presents the collaboration between Ralph Ellison and the great African American photographer and filmmaker, the first Black staff photographer of Life magazine, Gordon Parks. Mm-hmm. There were photos that were conjoined and that correspond to Ralph Ellison's great great essay. But one of the, you know, getting back to your question about, you know, the figure of Wortham and whether or not such a clinic would work being directed by this relatively thick accented Bavarian born non-religious Jewish man who was over 6 feet tall, lanky, and kind of daunting. I mean, to be honest, like, you know, maybe a scary figure to some. I mean, me included. I don't mean to be flippant about it, just or jokey. Point being, he could be an intimidating figure, but he was an extremely earnest figure who could talk the talk. He could explain that he wasn't therefore what he referred to as a reformist project, or to quote unquote study the Negro personality, which was, you know, in the wake of or in the midst of World War II, you know, in the midst of the great, well, you know, the big text, An American Dilemma, by Gunnar Myrdal, that's on the lips and minds of a lot of American social scientists and policy majors, to study, you know, what makes the Negro tick and what are the kind of endemic pathologies that inhibit his full inclusion in the body politic and social order. But to get to the point, Wortham, was initially denied by major philanthropies, including the Marshall Field Foundation. There's a great episode in chapter 3 that I want your readers to check out, where they are denied funding for the clinic on those exact reasons you pose to us about that they'll never come to him. They won't trust him. You know, the important aspect of why I introduced into the conversation Father Shelton Hale Bishop is because the fact that the clinic was housed in a church in the the title of chapter 3 is Between the Sewer and the Church, which comes from the original title of Ellison's essay, Harlem is Nowhere. The clinic was literally to the bottom is the sewer and above is the church. And this was a unique and safe space. And there's no other, you know, not to romanticize it, but it removed the stigma, I argue. The topic of stigma is on the lips of contemporary practitioners and researchers in the area of racialized health disparities. And, on the topic of mental health and mental health treatment and on a whole, the question of stigma. And the LaFarge Clinic being housed in a church signaled to community members that it was embraced and that they wouldn't be toyed with or messed with, or that their lives and minds would be taken seriously. And so Wortham brought a wealth of experience, right? Prior experience speaking with and relating to patients of all walks of life, including African American patients. But he moreover brought with him an earnest disposition to say, you know, I take your life seriously. I take your mind seriously. The protocols for treatment and directives to the staff. And in some ways, you captured that in that one page sheet to some, you know, the wind, mm-hmm. like of the orientation of the clinic that, I wish you had a visual to correspond to. I did an oral history with Shelton Hale Bishop's daughter, Dr. Elizabeth Bishop Davis Trussell, who was going to Columbia Medical School at the time of the LaFarge Clinic, and actually volunteered on the staff and, you know, subsequently became a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst and actually became the first head of the Department of Psychiatry at Harlem Hospital, which didn't have a Department of Psychiatry until 1962, by the way. And during my oral history, she had some memorabilia, and she, graciously gave me one of the brochures. She had a little batch of brochures, and it tells the hours of the clinic. And I just to lead into your kind of specific questions, right? It says the LaFarge Clinic is designed to provide expert psychotherapy for those who need it and cannot get it. Its services are available to any child or adult with or without referral from any public or private agency. A nominal fee of 25 cents, 50 cents for court testimony is charged for those who can afford it. And lastly, I just wanted to share this last point is on the flip side. It says the LaFarge Clinic is a clinic for the treatment of all kinds of nervous and mental disorders and behavior difficulties of adults and children. Its emphasis is not on testing and retesting, but on practical, intensive, and if necessary, prolonged psychotherapy. The diagnostic and psychotherapeutic methods employed are in accordance with the highest modern scientific standards. I appreciate you bearing with me when I read a few things here and there, because I know that's not the most conversational thing to do, but I just wanted to reference that. So in terms of both the orientation that Wortham brought and the kind of the specific protocols for intake and offering a form of social psychotherapy that paid attention, paid very close attention to the patient's place in the social order of things, so to speak, that didn't, which contrasted, this was an earlier question you had, kind of contrasted with forms of orthodox American forms of psychoanalysis, and that emphasized the family unit,
right?
Not necessarily to the exclusion of culture or society. In fact, there was a school of thought coming from out of like a neo-Freudianism, people like Karen Horney and Harry Stack Sullivan, mm-hmm. Dr. Harry Stack Sullivan, and in terms of the culture and personality school.
Right.
But the explicit reference and engagement with the context of racialization of, I mean, if you think about something like paranoia, right? If you think of an example like such as paranoia, like there's this great interview in 1960, shortly before Richard Wright dies, with a French journalist, and he's talking. They ask him about his involvement in psychology, psychiatry, and I don't remember if they asked specifically about the Lafargue Clinic, but they ask about it. And he says, "Well, you know," he gives this anecdote or scenario of a white patient and a black patient waiting to go into see the psychiatrist, and the white patient refers to being thinking that people are following him when he goes into a department store. He's followed by clerks. When the police pay attention to his every move. When he goes into a diner, he believes that he's being poisoned with salt or something, like, you know, and the doctor says, "Well, you know, you're paranoid, and you're showing signs of, you know, this, you know, of perhaps paranoid schizophrenia. You're fantasizing," and an African American patient comes in and describes the same experiences, and the doctor says the same very same thing to him. It's not taking it, Wright uses that as to say, you know, what is normal on a normal experience for an African American person in modern American society is diagnosed in the very same format as a white patient, because the particularity of that social experience is not taken into consideration. And while that's an anecdote and a portrait, I think in a lot of ways, Wright is in some ways distilling some of the unique orientations of the Lafargue Clinic. I know I've spoken far too long on that, but and I'm sure we need to wrap up soon.
Yeah, but, well, to wrap things up on the subject of race, I think that, you know, what's interesting is that Wright does kind of recede into the background pretty quickly.
Yes.
The camps for Paris.
Yes.
So I want to hear, just, you know, for our listeners, the kind of the fate of Wright and his involvement in the clinic, then the fate of Wortham, as you were talking about, who went on to write The Seduction of the Innocent and is now known as a comic book crusader, and then the eventual fate of the clinic and how that shut down. So to sort of tie the story together.
Thank you. Thank you for redirecting me there. Richard Wright expatriates. He leaves. He quits the United States and moves to France to live in Paris in 1947. And he still remains on the board of directors of the Lafargue Clinic and makes writes things here and there for fundraising and for to publicize the work of the clinic. But on to be very straightforward, he doesn't participate in the day-to-day operations of the clinic much after really getting the clinic off the ground. And I, you know, that's something I wrestled with in the narrative, right? Of, in the sense of, you know, he's this formative, like invaluable figure in the establishment and, initial, launch of the clinic. But then again, largely recedes. His contributions, I argue, really warranted his place within the narrative of the clinic. He becomes much more of a kind of international citizen. There's no doubt about it. So that his, while his interests, of course, remain diagnosing and explaining the workings of race in the United States, he turns his attention very much to the kind of the question of global colonialism and anti-colonialism, of the context of questions around war and well, not to be too corny, but war and peace of staving off future world wars. And his fiction varies between kind of wrestling with forms of existentialism, but also he later does return back to a very rooted African-American narratives. And as my dissertation advisor, Jim Campbell, shows in his book, Middle Passages, African-American Journeys to Africa, he actually shows very interestingly how Wright retained his orientations in the Chicago school and Freudian psychoanalysis as he encounters the rest of the world. And famously in his book, Black Power, which is kind of the first enunciation of that phrase, he writes this book about Ghana in the midst of Nkrumah's ascendancy and anti-colonial, decolonial efforts. And his descriptions of the relationship between African colonial life and modern Europe, the modern European westernization, he distills his descriptions of this antagonism or encounter through the very orientations that actually were expressed and actually, I argue, like, you know, led into his involvement with the Lafar Clinic. And so, yes, he does recede from the narrative, but there are a few later encounters that I actually don't write about, but I might take up in some subsequent work in some interesting ways. But I'm going to bracket that. Mm-hmm. And Wortham comes to be a kind of flashpoint for the question of the relationship between mass media in the form of crime comic books and the question of juvenile delinquency and not just juvenile delinquency, but violence. It centers on the question of violence. What sources contribute to young people's enacting of violence, either to oneself or to others? And at the same time that Wortham is encountering and observing the role of violent crime comic books in the lives of young children that he's encountering at, very famously, at the Lafar Clinic, and at his work at the psychiatric clinic at Queens General Hospital, at the very same time that he's trying to assess and make sense of the role of these crime comic books, he's also being asked to participate in the scientific testimony in the two Delaware school desegregation cases that were later that were bundled as companion cases with Brown v. Board of Education. And for the first time, in no other cases, in the four other cases besides Brown v. Board, in no other cases were both white and black children examined in a clinical setting. You know, the testimony largely focused on the pernicious effects of segregation on the psyches of black children. But Wortham insisted that the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund lawyers, Jack Greenberg and Thurgood Marshall, that they bring both white and black children to the LaFar Clinic. And they did, on five occasions, brought black group of black and white children to be examined. And what and he testifies in the Delaware case and actually sways the judge. It's the only case of the five cases that went into Brown v. Board of Education. It's the only case in which the plaintiffs won, in which the plaintiffs, those suing for desegregation, won. But he couldn't, but the judge couldn't strike down desegregation because it was because of precedent that it had to be decided by the Supreme Court. And what links both the seduction of the innocent and the school desegregation testimony is Wortham's concern of framing of both issues in terms of a threat to public health. He, from the linchpin between his work in Seduction of the Innocent and the school desegregations, is the notion of identifying and eradicating sources of threat to the emotional and mental health of children. And he argues on the one case that these violent crime comics, on the other, state-sanctioned segregation and anti-black racism. And one of the kind of largely overlooked components of Seduction of Innocent is that there's a case that Wortham makes about the relationship between of racist representation and violence, and the kind of the opening of permission to be violent towards the capital O other, right?
Yeah.
And so ultimately, Wortham has tremendous sway. He has tremendous sway, but then just almost as immediately as he has sway, he is kind of written out of the narrative of the Brown v. Board of Education social science contribution, but very much is written into the kind of as the arch villain, and for some reasons right, and I would argue for some reasons wrong, written as the arch kind of arch the archetype for a villainous censor.
Yeah, and then so, yeah. You know, to add insult to injury, almost, it seems like his efforts with the LaFarge Clinic and the way in which they're enacted basically exempt the clinic itself from support in legislature that gets passed to fund similar kinds of institutions. So
absolutely.
It's sort of like that becomes the nail in the coffin for the clinic, really.
Absolutely. In the very same year, 1954. That's a pivotal year, right? It's a good year on one, right? It's the Brown v. Board of Education in May of 1954. But you know, and Seduction of the Innocent is published in 1954. But in New York State, the Community Mental Health Services Act seems to be this auspicious occasion and opportunity for the LaFar Clinic to get the resources it has dreamed about since its inception. And they're denied they're denied through several applications for funding. They are denied, and it's because, I mean, frankly, Wortham was a prickly figure. Mm-hmm. Where he often ostracized those who could be most possibly in his corner, because I think the term idea fix was made for him, right? The idea that his way, he had an idea and it had to be done exactly his way, and he wouldn't, truck or traffic in any watered down versions of anything, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so in 1954, at this, the auspicious enactment of the Community Mental Health Services Act, the clinic itself doesn't get funding, and by it hangs on and offers services for 4 more years. And I always say when I'm talking about the clinic, 12 years is a long time for a do-it-yourself institution, mm-hmm. of grassroots institution building. 12 years of an all-volunteer staff operating every Tuesday and Friday evening. That's a long time. You look at it on a timeline and it's a blip, but 12 years of week in and week out offering patient of thousands of patients, recurring and humane and democratized psychotherapy when they didn't have access in any other institution of its type. That's something to commend the significance of this clinic. And moreover, I would argue that, the model of the clinic, maybe not all of its elements, would come to later serve as a kind of, the model would in some ways be picked up, in a later iteration, and that being the community mental health movement of the 1960s. And in fact, I'm not going to say that there's this direct correlation, because there isn't, but some of the figures, including people that I, great octogenarians that I interviewed who were staff members, including Father Bishop's daughter, Dr. Bishop Davis Chosel, and the figure of someone with one of the greatest names I've ever encountered is Dr. June Jackson Christmas. Dr. June Jackson Christmas was a medical student, and then an intern at Queens General Hospital, and a student, supervised by Dr. Wortham. She later becomes in the 1970s, the New York City Commissioner of Public Health. And so she cut her teeth, so to speak, at the Lafar Clinic in terms of her approach to offering, in terms of public health and of a humane practice of psychiatry. And so there's an individual legacy, but there's a, I think in some ways there's a kind of a spiritual legacy that gets picked up later on. And in a lot of ways, for me, the exciting point about recapturing this history in some ways, I mean, well, the story has been told in portions by other excellent scholars. This is the first comprehensive study of the Lafar Clinic in Under the Strain of Color. It offers to contemporary scholars and practitioners a model. It says, hey, there was this model of intervention that foregrounded the social context and social experience of forms of oppression, straight up oppression, not to dance away from a term that people don't always use, but oppressive life circumstances structured upon race and labor inequality, that there was this model that existed back in the day. But this story has resonated because, you know, a lot of contemporary practitioners are wrestling with questions around, you know, questions around cultural competency, around what the psychiatrist and scholar Jonathan Metzl refers to as structural competency. You know, these are concerns and questions that are on the lips and minds of contemporary medical practitioners and social workers and others. So, you know, having this history serve as an alternate model for intervention, you know, kind of beyond the primarily biophysical approach. I'm kind of opening up a can of worms with that, but if that's one thing that this book kind of gestures toward is to kind of juxtapose an earlier model of social psychiatry, kind of not over and against, but side by side with the kind of well, for lack of a better word, hegemonic biophysical biomedical approach to psychiatry that reigns right now. There's another model that I think can be usefully juxtaposed. So
well, thank you for that. That was a very nice suggestion of the potential scope of influence of the book. And on that note, I was wondering if, you know, we're kind of running out of time, but I was hoping you could briefly summarize what your current project is, and how it speaks to or many of these issues you've discussed.
Thank you for that question, because, you know, it's something, and it was connected to another question on my mind. It's sort of like, you know, what is it I didn't do in this book that I would have loved to do, or what, you know, and it really does connect. I'm currently beginning work on my second single authored book, and that's called Through the Glass Darkly, Race and Madness in Modern America. And it's a much more broad scope text that looks in a comparative and relational way at the intersections of racialization and mental health, mental illness within various populations, African American, indigenous and native peoples, Latinos in the Southwest, Latinos in the Northeast, as well, and other populations. And looks at this larger question of what is the relationship, and just poses the basic question of what's the relationship between questions of racialization and mental health and mental illness, both at a kind of discursive construction of science level and also lived experience level, as well as, and this is where it's interdisciplinary, looks at questions of kind of representation of like the image and idea of madness, and to what degree the objects of research and institutionalization, in whatever way, the objects, those populations, to what degree have they maneuvered or discerned or offered up alternate models and meanings of madness? And so one of the things that I've always wished in retrospect, like kind of wish I could have done a little bit, well, if I had had access in some ways to how African Americans themselves in Harlem, or even coming from whichever traditions, or maybe even like folk traditions, how they themselves saw the meanings of madness, meanings of mental disorder, and how they interpreted modern psychiatric practices in the context of the LaFar Clinic's operation. Of course, I pay close attention to the patient files, but as we know, as sources, they are distilled through the pen of the recorder, who is not without his or her own interpretive biases. So not to say that I could get direct, you know, access to, you know, how did people think about, you know, because it's, you know, all sources are mediated to some extent, but at least one of the things I'm aiming that and kind of picking up where I wasn't able to go as far as I would have liked, picking up that and enacting in my contemporary research an attention and attunement to being attuned to how the communities who are and populations who are the targets or objects of research and institutionalization, how they themselves respond to or offer up alternate visions or versions of mental illness or mental health. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. Well, that sounds very exciting, and look forward to maybe in a few years' time hearing about that work.
Absolutely. I'll get it to your desk very soon.
Excellent. Well, Gabriel, thanks so much for your time and for this wonderful discussion. And to our listeners, absolutely check out Gabriel's book. It's available through Cornell University Press. Thanks so much for listening. This has been New Books in Medicine.